The preceding program was a pre-recorded presentation of WUSB, Stony Brook.
It's a rather rainy Monday afternoon in Stony Brook, and good afternoon to you. Welcome to Chatterbox, the hour-long talk program that comes your way every Monday afternoon at this time. We have talk programs all week long at this time, so be sure to tune in every weekday at 2:30 p.m. Well, my guest today is Jan Hickman, who is Manager of Corporate Communications for the Long Island Lighting Company and also is Chief Spokesperson. And we also have Nancy Makenko, who is Manager of Employee Communications at LUCO. I'd like to welcome you both to the program.
Thank you, Eric. It's good being here.
And how long have you been working at LUCO, Jan Hickman?
I joined LUCO on January 3rd, 1977, directly from the state U at Stony Brook, where I was Assistant News Director with the University Relations Office on main campus.
Now known as
Stony Brook to LUCO.
Now known as University News Services.
Is that what it's known as? Good heavens.
Yeah, I don't know why they changed their name.
We all get so old. Nancy joins LUCO in 1979, directly also from Stony Brook, where she was Director of Student Activities and Alumni Director and Community Relations Director for a while.
So you both are Stony Brook graduates.
We aren't graduates of Stony Brook's academic program. I graduated from Syracuse University and Nancy from Miami of Ohio. But we had our first, maybe last, real grown-up administrative jobs here, yes.
Uh-huh. And you were into administration from the beginning, is that correct?
Correct.
Now, what made you pick LUCO?
Okay, at that time I'd worked I'd worked in an academic environment for quite a long time. I was 26 years old. At that time at the State University at Stony Brook, and I'm dating now here to the mid to late 1970s, that was kind of a middle to old age to be an administrator here, and I was looking for something different, a challenge. LUCO contacted me. I knew that they were involved in a variety of controversial issues, which I never got the experience in dealing with at Stony Brook. I very, very much enjoyed working in an academic atmosphere. Stony Brook, I think, is unique among a lot of major colleges and centers of higher learning. The diverse faculty, the staff was incredible. The student body was always kept you hopping, did new and different things every day. So that while it was very, very busy and it was very much real world, the corporate side of it offered a different experience, which I felt and still feel is a very, very important one to experience.
Now, what year was this again that you were at Stony Brook?
I started with Stony Brook in 1975 and worked here through 1976 and into early 1977.
Okay, so you missed the really exciting times in the 60s when there were riots and things.
I missed it, but it was almost, if you joined Stony Brook at any time in the 1970s, you had this parade of people who would come in with scrapbooks and you'd see slideshows and films, and I used to go back and read old issues of Statesman and talk to people who were at USB during that entire period. So, and also Stony Brook gained such a national rep during that period, Eric, of the 1960s, that no matter where you were, unless you were on Mars, there was no way that you could escape knowing the State Youth Center. Just coming back here today has been an incredible experience in that. When I stopped working here, we were still doing things like clawing, you know, foot and nail for parking, and trudging through several feet of mud to get to our building, and that's totally different now. It's extremely attractive. It's very aesthetic and appealing.
Maybe
that's where my head is right now compared to where it was back then.
Did you have any trouble finding parking today?
As a matter of fact, no, and we're still trying to figure out why, but it was almost like a god was smiling on us today to find parking.
Well, the mud is sort of gone away, but it's still in various places around campus. You have to look a little harder for it, but there is mud. I'm sure lots of people out there will attest to that.
I think it's also a different perspective, and probably for Nancy also, is that once you leave the university's administration in a work environment. You start reading newspaper stories about it. You approach it with a whole different perspective. I know that the campus in recent months has gotten a lot of press from the Baby Jane Doe incident and from many others. And you attach a whole other perspective to it. I think that the campus has come out very, very well during the past few months, by the way.
246-7901 is our telephone number, area code 516. If you have a question for Jan Hickman of LOCO or Nancy McKenko, also of LOCO, I'd like to ask, I guess, both of you, when you first got started with LOCO, what kind of things were you doing?
Okay, speaking for myself, when I joined the lighting company, we were and still are, of course, involved in a variety of controversial projects. But basically, you have an entity, LOCO, which is a major gas and electric utility in the state of New York. It somehow successfully gets out electric service to more than 3 million people a day, gas service to fewer than half that. But the basic thing then was and still is that you left one kind of service environment to join another kind of service environment. LOCO, for example, I think more so than the campus environment, is a 24-hour service. It offers electricity and gas service on a 24-hour basis. When I first joined, I was part of the media staff at LOCO, and now I head that staff. Basically, in my current position, we deal with about more than 3,000 inquiries for media per year that come into our office. These are more than half of them at the moment relate in some fashion to our Shoreham Nuclear Power Station, which, as you know, is under construction out in eastern Suffolk County. Those questions range from the economics of Shoreham to various aspects of its safety, various aspects of its construction and licensing history. Many other questions, however, are directed to the things that we do on a day-to-day basis, get out electric service and get out gas service. We do have the best record in the state on supplying electric service with the fewest outages, and those that happen are of the shortest duration. Now, that's for a whole lot of reasons, and not just because we're terrific and fine. But we do have a service record to be proud of. Of course, a lot of the press activity in recent years, and particularly in recent months, has centered around Shoreham, which is a very controversial project.
Now, why is it such a controversial project? There are nuclear power plants all over the country. Why is Shoreham so controversial?
You know, that's absolutely true, Eric, and that's something that we ask ourselves very, very often. With more than 80 plants operating in this country and a couple of hundred worldwide, why does Shoreham receive so much attention and why is it admired in so much controversy? I think you've got a couple of unique and specific elements in this area that are present in much lesser degrees elsewhere. First and foremost, of course, among them is that although we have been planning the power plant at Shoreham since the mid-1960s, have been actively involved in its construction since the early 1970s, we have a local government in Suffolk County which has tended to behave in the last 9 or 10 months or so as though they just found out that a big nuclear power plant has all of a sudden sprung forth full-formed out in eastern Suffolk County. Now, that position has tended to give us a lot of problems since prior to that, every other Suffolk County administration supported the continual building of that power plant, as did the appropriate state and federal regulatory agencies. So I think that's one particular posture which has tended to get us a lot of attention. Moreover, for very simple and basic reasons, we're at the point now where our Shoreham Nuclear Power Station is virtually complete. We have to clear up one remaining mechanical problem with a machine called a backup diesel generator before we actually get clearance to load fuel. So we're at the point right now where all parties are starting to come together on how are we going to put our Shoreham plant into Long Island's electric rate base. There's no question that when that happens, it will cause an impact in electric bills. I think what everybody has been working on, the governor's staff, Senator D'Amato's staff, LILCO for at least 3 years, and all the appropriate agencies, is a way to get Shoreham into service and spread out the impact on electric bills over a period of time until the point in time several years down the road where you start seeing Shoreham's economic benefit vis-a-vis the oil prices. I think another reason why the plant gets a lot of attention is that Long Island is unique among any area in the entire country in that on the island we are still forced to generate all of our electricity for all 3 million people here using OPEC oil. Everywhere else in the country has something else online, whether it's coal-fired power, natural gas, hydroelectric power, nuclear power, but some other form of energy generation other than that fueled by OPEC oil. This area is still the only area of the country where all of your local generating stations are oil-fired stations, so that has tended to give our impetus to get Shoreham online a great deal of the desire to hurry it up.
Now, the original plan was for actually three plants on Long Island, two in Jamesport,
correct,
one in Shoreham.
Correct.
How has the cancellation of the two in Jamesport affected both the Shoreham plant and LUCO?
What that has done, while those projects were being planned independently and considered and licensed independent of one another, the fact that our planned two-unit Jamesport project was... we canceled that plan a while ago, as did the New York State Siting Board, but the appropriate agency, which in this state is called the Siting Board, certified us to build coal plants at Jamesport instead. Now, we have no immediate need for that kind of additional generating capacity. What it does do, however, is since the process right now for building and siting and getting all the approvals for and the construction time for large coal plants is very, very similar to that currently bogs down major nuclear projects, it makes us even more panicky to get something else but oil online. I think one of the problems, Eric, is that, and you probably see this in a certain campus sense also, is that people's memory of pain and discomfort is very, very short, and we tend not to remember back to 3 years ago when we were all sitting in gas lines, and back to 1973 when, because of the OPEC oil embargo, LUCO had 10 days of oil left to keep the lights on here. We were at that time meeting with state and federal people trying to get oil shifted to us from anywhere else in the entire world. Although we're in a period right now which is an unusual one in that for the last year and a half, the cost of oil has stabilized and the supplies seem very, very easy. I think given the state of world politics, particularly in the Mideast section, it would be folly for us or anyone else to continue to imagine that we can continue to be an all-oil-fired operation.
Last oil shortage with gas lines and everything, do you believe that was a genuine shortage?
You know, a lot of people back then were asking me that, and my bottom line is I really don't care. I don't care whether it's artificial or whether it's real, because the bottom line is we still feel it. So we could probably indulge in academic discussions for years and years over whether that is that was or is a manufactured crisis, an artificial one, or a so-called real supply crisis, but the point is, if you're sitting there waiting for a tanker to dock and it's not coming, the ephemeral ivory tower questions are meaningless at that point. All you know is that you can't get the oil to keep the lights on here.
We're talking with Jan Hickman, who is manager of corporate communications and chief spokesperson for the Long Island Lighting Company. And we're talking about the Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant and all kinds of other fun things involving LUCO. This is a call-in program. If you want to call in with a question or comment, our number is 246-7901. And one thing you mentioned a few minutes ago, Jan, is the county government.
Mm-hmm.
You said in the last 9 or 10 months they've suddenly started acting as if this plant suddenly popped up out of nowhere. Why do you suppose they're doing that?
I think, you know, I hate to describe motivation because I'm not a sociologist, and this campus has a very fine department of people who do nothing but that and try to analyze why people behave the way that they do behave. However, I will say that given the timing of all the events that surrounded the county executive's coming out with his posture on Shoreham, I would, as many political pundits and press analysts have since then, ascribe it to some degree to pure political opportunism or whim. Now, there's no question that nuclear power as an issue has become a tremendously unpopular one in recent years. It's also worthy of note that at the time that we started to build Shoreham, it was an overwhelmingly popular enterprise. So that I think what you've got here are politicians specifically one, but more than that, who looked at a poll and said, this is the way that we're going to go, and we hope that it will, in fact, get us a lot of votes. Now, the interesting thing that happened is with the election last week or the week before last, all of the analysts who subsequently wrote it up, in fact, said that Shoreham was not the decisive issue, Shoreham was not the major issue, and in fact, that it was extremely surprising how small a plurality the incumbent was able to amass, given his very strong, very vocal, and from my perspective, very political position on Shoreham. Now, from the lighting company's perspective, you've got a utility, which is not essentially a political entity. The people there have been trained and trained very well, and most of them are 30-year employees, 40-year employees, to do certain things well, to get the gas out, to get the electric out, to get the trucks out, to build a transmission line, to build an oil plant, to build a nuclear power plant. That's what they're into. We are engineers, we are planners, we are thinkers to a certain extent, but we are not by our very nature political people. I think we've been dragged kicking and screaming over the last few years into that fray as a result of the projects that we're involved in becoming so politicized in nature. But one of the interesting dichotomies that has developed, not just on Long Island or with Shoreham, but all over the country, is that utilities, by their very nature, are long-term planners. We've been around since 1910. We have to plan right now to begin building a 15 or 20-year project to have it online for your kids 25 years from now. I think that many public officials, not all, but many, are by their very nature short-term planners, and that their thinking gets them to November or to, at most, 2 or 4 years from now.
Okay, we'll get back to the politics and the long-range planning in just a moment. We have a call at 246-7901. Hello, USB, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to ask this person what LUCO is doing about promoting conservation as an alternative to using OPEC oil.
Certainly.
And if they are doing anything, why are they pushing the heat pump, which is as a means of heating and cooling houses, when that makes more electricity being needed?
Okay, certainly. I think that I can say without blushing that LUCO has done more than any single entity on Long Island, more than any county government, more than any ad hoc group to promote conservation. And that's simply because we are the people who have the lights in your homes and who can tell you about it. We have run do-it-yourself insulation seminars. We run free consumer education classes. We consistently mail out material with your electric and gas bills showing you how to conserve energy. We also, as part of a New York State program, offer free energy audits for the home, which many hundreds of thousands of people on the island have taken advantage of. So we do a whole lot, in fact, much more than any other single entity that I know of, to promote conservation on the island. Now, here's where a little irony comes in. On the island, most of the homes on Long Island, more than 80%, are heated by oil, are heated by home heating oil. Only about 3 or 4% are heated by either electric resistance heat or electric heat pumps. So that when you're talking about cooling and heating, you're basically talking about home heating oil. That's where your conservation with adding insulation, with installing a heat pump, basically comes in. If you build a home and you install a heat pump rather than install an oil-fired system, then you are basically hitting your conservation of OPEC, your conservation of oil factor right there. There are a variety of other things that.
Well, this heat pump is going to be run on electricity.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
So I mean that's still going to be generated by oil.
Correct.
Why would you not suggest that they put solar heating on their houses
as
backup?
Absolutely. In fact, we have a program going that has installed, I believe, several solar heating systems with electric heat pump backups. If I'm right, Nancy. Okay. So that is a developing technology that we are very seriously trying to get into. But to answer your initial question, the amount of oil needed to generate the very small amount of comparative electricity that a heat pump uses is minimal compared to the same amount of oil that would be needed to heat an oil-heated home.
You touched for a moment there on solar power and said something that I've heard so many times as far as it's got a lot of promise and we're working on it, but when is it going to have more than just a lot of promise?
Well, right now, we are, in fact, we recently received several national commendations for it. Several years ago, we were the first utility in the nation to install more than 600 solar water heating systems in average, everyday LI homes, not your big mansions out in East Hampton and not your big ones out in Hewlett or Lloyd Harbor, but average, everyday homes that people use and live in on a day-to-day basis. There is no question that solar, for some applications of home heating with a backup source and water heating, is here. It's right here and now. I think, Eric, where people tend to get confused is they think that somehow the solar, the large-scale generation of baseload electricity using solar power is here and now, and unfortunately it isn't.
Not the case.
Correct. There's also, we are not partners, we are associated with another utility in New Mexico who, at the same time that we began installing solar water heating systems in homes on the island, an outfit in Albuquerque started it there also. So we are presently, recognizing and applauding the fact that the solar application is here and now for some forms of home heating and water heating. It's still quite a ways from being able to take the place of a large-scale power plant of a conventional means, but it's something that we've invested a lot of money in, a lot of time in, a lot of people in, and that we're really looking forward to as a great hope for the future.
Okay, can I ask you one more thing?
Okay, of course. We have to get to another call, but ask one more question.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In that there's not really that much building going on Long Island right now. Most of the homes are built already. Most of the heat pumps are going to be put in retroactively. So there's already existing heating systems in these houses. It seems to me that LUCO is pushing the heat pump in order to increase the need for electricity so that they can justify opening the Shoreham plant. I'd just like to know what you have to say about that.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because it reminds me of an aspect of your earlier question that I failed to answer, and that is simply that one of the reasons why we are, as you say, pushing the electric heat pump as our outfits all over the country, including the federal administration, is that the heat pump has a vast potential to make use of what we call off-peak electricity. That is, on the island and in many other parts of the country, you've got to generate all of your generating capacity or get all of it up to peak and up to speed during certain hours during the daytime when people are in offices using air conditioners, in schools using their stereos and so forth. A lot of that capacity sits idle at night, but you can't just close it down because come morning you need all that stuff all over again. The electric heat pump, particularly the technology that helps store electricity at night, or helps at least kick it up at night, has a vast potential to make use of some of that off-peak power, which will help spread out the fixed cost on that power plant equipment. There was another part of your question that I believe I didn't answer. What was the second part?
In that you're going to be increasing the demand for electricity, you'll be justifying
the
fact that Shoreham has to be
open. Right. Okay. I think that were Shoreham not even here, we would still be taking the steps that we have taken with electric heat pumps. But there was something else in your question which touched something, which is that when you said that there's not a lot of building going on the island, I have now... if it were 3 years ago, I think I might agree with that statement, but I have now seen article after article. I have driven through
Levittowns going up. There's no huge building things going on. I mean, they're putting expensive little houses along the North Shore.
I think they're putting pretty middle-class houses up, too, because my husband and I bought one recently. But the point is that there is an awful lot that the residential and commercial building has undergone a tremendous resurgence in the last year or so, to the point that the Long Island Regional Planning Board expects that there will be substantial high-tech business and additional residential building for years to come. Even with that great building almost stoppage that other parts of the area saw in the late 1970s.
What areas do you see the building going
okay,
on?
Okay, sir, we have another call that's been waiting for
okay,
a while.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Our telephone number is 246-7901. You're listening to WUSB in Stony Brook, and the program is Chatterbox. We have Jan Hickman, chief spokesperson from LOCO, as our guest today. And let's go to this call. USB, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For Ms. Hickman.
Yes.
You mentioned that the current Suffolk County administration has been a big source of problems for LOCO.
Mm-hmm.
And the delays that you've experienced, which I agree with. I realize that it's caused you, quite a bit of worry. But before nine months ago, before Cohalan or any of these people started to make a major issue of Shoreham, LOCO had been incurring delays and cost overruns for
certainly
quite a long time before that.
Certainly.
So how would you explain that?
Certainly. Okay. To try to capsulize Shoreham's tremendous several-year construction history into kind of a brief outline, because we would take all of Eric's program plus the next 4 days to go into the whole thing blow by blow. What basically has happened is, for a second, look at Shoreham, but look at Shoreham and also about two dozen other very high cost, very, very recent capital projects, both nuclear and coal-fired power plants that are about to come online. And you'll find that all of those plants, I'm talking about plants from Long Island to New Hampshire to Arizona to California to Iowa to Illinois and all over the country, are many, many, many times their initial cost and are many, many, many years past their initial hoped for online dates. Now, that results from a variety of factors. I think in the generic case, first and foremost among them, which of course affected Shoreham also, is the fact that these plants were built largely during the 1970s, during a period of time which saw a record double-digit interest and inflation. Further, these plants were built during what had been and what is still the most chaotic, changing regulatory environment for building a nuclear power plant. The numbers of regulations, both on a federal level and industry codes, which govern the building of these power plants, multiplied dramatically and changed with a great deal of rapidity, to the point that you had Shoreham and many other plants affected by these rapidly changing regs. Now, that, of course, increased by quantum leaps following the accident at Three Mile Island. Now, to get to the Shoreham-specific case, those three things all contributed to what we have right now, how much it cost, and why it's only now that we're almost about to start loading fuel. Shoreham had another extra added delight in that in Shoreham's early construction history, we started our hearings before the federal government for a construction permit in early 1970. At that time, other nuclear power plants that were entering their construction permit hearings sailed through those hearings before the federal government in an average of 7 days. Shoreham's construction permit hearings before the federal government took about 3 years, which set a still-standing record before the old Atomic Energy Commission, now the federal NRC. That early delay, true, was quote-unquote only 3 years, but that pushed us right into that era of double-digit inflation, of skyrocketing interest rates, and of rapidly changing federal regs, so that all of those things combined to give us what we have now, which is an extremely high-cost power plant. But I have to point out again that that high cost and what Shoreham will produce in terms of impact on rates is by no means unique in the country.
Well, I would like to say, first of all, that the percentage of increase in terms of cost for Shoreham quite outdistances most any plant that I've come across or I've read about. I would also like to say that you seem to be mentioning every other possible variable in terms of promoting this cost overrun, but I would like you to address the situation of LOCO's handling of Shoreham.
I certainly will.
The fact that LOCO has no experience previously with nuclear power, and that I would like to know how much you attribute to the mismanagement of...
Okay. I'd like to address a couple of those things in sequence, and the first thing is that I disagree that the kind of hikes you saw in Shoreham's price will be unique. I think all one need do in this day and age is pick up the Wall Street Journal once a week to find out that, in fact, plants that are about as old as we are or about as ready as we are going through now what we went through about 2 years ago, in that they're only now beginning to give their most recent estimates and including their interest costs and things like that. Comparisons of nuclear power plants is a very tricky thing, because what you have happening, Lilco, for example, in its cost estimates for the Shoreham plant, includes as a part of that cost a terribly horrible technical accounting term called AFC, or Allowance for Funds Used During Construction. To boil it down, what that means is that we include as part of the cost of the plant all of the interest and carrying costs on the money that we borrowed from investors to build that plant. Now, that lump sum is fully a third of Shoreham's entire cost. It's almost $1 billion. If you look across the country at the estimates for some other nuclear power plants, you will find that some of them will give you their most recent estimate, but they treat that account, they treat that interest and carrying cost separately, so they'll look a whole lot lower than we will look. But I think particularly now in the last few months, we have seen many, many examples of plants that have had the same magnitude of cost increases as has Shoreham. Now let me get to the issue of mismanagement. I've been really wanting to do that for about 35 minutes now. And that's because for the last couple of years, we have heard with increasing frequency from public officials and from consumer groups and from real people and from people at the deli and people at the gas station that the reason why you have a plant that's got to cost that much and that's that far along and that took that long to build is you must be incredibly mismanaged. I'd like to answer that in a variety of ways. First, to say that, again, Shoreham wasn't built in a closet. It was built all along with approvals as needed from the appropriate, particularly state, regulatory agencies. Now, they didn't just rubber stamp things. They, in fact, throughout Shoreham's history, conducted several audits of that project, the most recent one, I believe, being about 2 years ago. In no instance have they found any instance of mismanagement or unreasonable expenditure out there. Furthermore, you're looking not only at Long Island Lighting Company, but at other companies around the country who have successfully built power plants online, on time, and on or under budget for many, many years, and all of a sudden they're building nuclear plants that are costing much, much more than the utilities themselves, when they started out, ever expected. Now, the answer can be twofold. Either there was a severe management virus that went around and hit all the utilities at the same time in the same place, and utilities that were previously well-managed and had good reps became horribly mismanaged overnight, or there really were and are these generic concerns that affected the building of all power plants. Now, it is true that Shoreham is Lilco's first nuclear power plant. Because of the nature of the technology and the time involved to build the plants, it will probably be our last nuclear power plant. There are, however, many other utilities and entities, including so-called public power entities or government power entities around the country, who have also, one must start somewhere, built their first nuclear power plant. Now, in order to do it, we went out and got for the management of a good portion of that plant executives and managers and field people from other utilities that had already been in the process of building nuclear power plants.
You said that this will probably be the last nuclear power plant. Are you implying that nuclear power is going to be a thing of the past?
So no, I think what it basically is a recognition that in this day and age, it takes such an awful darn long time to go through all your controversial licensing and spend a dozen years in licensing, then another 10 years in construction. Lilco and many other utilities never have been wedded to one form of power generation. In the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, Lilco burned coal. We weren't married to it. As soon as a cleaner thing came along, and at that time a cheaper thing, oil, we switched over to oil. Nuclear power, once we started looking in the mid-1960s at the situation where we would be a completely oil-fired operation, we saw the folly in that and moved toward nuclear power as an aid to getting off of some of that oil. Now, down the road, not at this moment, but down the road, we can see ourselves going into refuse, to resources recovery type power plants, smaller power plants, hopefully ultimately into solar photovoltaic types of generation, which are being worked on but are not here and now. Many in the federal government a few years ago were trying to force us to go back to coal at all of our oil-fired plants. I don't think that the island is ready for that right now. But if we are unable to get off of some of this oil and another oil crisis occurs, then we could very well see ourselves hurrying up to convert at least one oil-fired power plant to coal if SHORM didn't come online.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yes.
Okay, that'll be your last question.
Okay, fine. Could you just please explain a little bit in terms of the savings from SHORM, being that our electric rates are going to rise by such an exorbitant amount, and I'm sure you want to stretch them out as much as possible, but there's no possible way that if that plant opens that there's not going to be a major shock to public, to commercial businesses because of rates. How can you feel that SHORM at some point down the line is actually going to save us money?
Okay. The what SHORM will save in future years is totally tied to what the cost of the oil will be in future years that SHORM will help displace. Now, if the oil prices stay just where they are now, which is relatively stable, as they have been for about a year or so, if all of the analysts are wrong and oil prices stay at this nice, flat, agreeable level out 10 and 20 years from now, then SHORM won't be a net electric bill saver for a long, long time. However, if, as most analysts predict, oil prices begin a gradual rise in the next year or two and go on from there, then SHORM will save that much faster. However,
SHORM has a life of only 30 years.
No, that's not true. SHORM has an accounting life at the moment of 30 years because you have to pick a number over which to depreciate a fixed power plant operation. However, SHORM can easily have an operating life of 40 years or more. But let me just finish my thought. In terms of oil savings, I don't think there's certainly I have no crystal ball. Nobody on campus does. Nobody at the utility or in the federal government does. And I would be delighted to sit down with all you folks in about 10 years and see which one was closer to being right. But the additional point is that the price of oil and its economics is one factor. If the oil at some point is not going to be there for you, then that's totally something else again.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to say despite what you said before, you're a very good politician.
Well, I appreciate talking to you all.
Thanks for calling. That's a good point. Do you ever consider running for public office?
No, I don't think that would be quite be my bag.
Now, you are, whenever something happens involving the SHORM plant, you're the person who says what's going on in
Lucas
view. How did you catapult into that position, and do you at all regret being in that position at any time?
I think that, okay, a couple of things. Often people who are in the public relations environment, so to speak, get a very bad cast on them, or kind of a halo in reverse, in that if you're in PR, public relations, then you're an automatic liar and you cover up and you whitewash things and stuff. Well, I think from my perspective that's basically a crock. You couldn't live with yourself if you weren't comfortable with what you were saying. If I didn't agree with the rationale and philosophy behind the SHORM power plant, then I couldn't be saying the things that I say, and I would leave. There is a market out there for folks who have been what I've been through, so I don't think there would be any question that I could easily go somewhere else. But in fact, I do absolutely believe it. Are there times when I regret it? Not in relationship to SHORM that much, but there are times when, given the fact that Wilco has been increasingly thrust into the national media, the demands on all of our time, Nancy's time, my time, my staff's time, is very, very great. And there are some Sundays where I talk to media all day that I just think that maybe I'd be real fine just being something else, but not recently. Most of the time it's really kind of an exciting environment because energy, I think more so than many other disciplines, is an extremely fast-changing thing. And after you've had Shoreham up to the teeth and you say, if I get one more Shoreham question, I'm going to go out of my mind, somebody will call and say, well, look, the lights are out in Belmore, and bring you right back down to basics, which is what you do every day, mm-hmm. which is get electric and gas service out there.
I see. Again, our telephone number is 246-7901, area code 516. We're speaking with Jan Hickman of LOCO, and a lot of interesting things are, of course, happening with the Shoreham nuclear plant, but a couple of other proposals that were raised in the last year or so involve such things as the abandoned Jamesport plant and also the Port Jefferson plant with conversions
yes.
to coal. Now, what's going on there?
Interestingly enough, Eric, converting the Port Jefferson power plant from an oil-fired power plant, which it currently is, to, or in one unit's case, back to a coal-fired operation, also, the future of that endeavor is also totally tied to the price of oil. If oil prices go up a lot, it'll really make a lot of economic sense to convert that power plant to coal. And it can be done in such a way. Let me back up for a second. I'm from a coal mining family. Nancy, who's sitting here, is from a coal mining family. And we remember coal back when we were very tiny children in the 50s. And that's when coal was ugly, black, dirty, dumb, deadly stuff. And you didn't want it near your house. You didn't want it in your neighborhood. You didn't want it fouling your clothesline. There have been tremendous advances.
It's changed.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was just part of my very fabric and skin, I was very, very much against when the company first started talking, when LOCO first started talking about the idea of converting this nice, kind of non-controversial Port Jeff power plant to coal.
Do you have a say in something like that? If you disagree with the policy, you can say you disagree with it?
I make my feelings known in the loudest possible manner at all times, but I went to a number of sessions. I also got a lot of material from other areas of the country which have been either building new coal plants or converting older oil plants to coal. And in fact, what has happened is that since the time when I was a tiny child to right now, there have been substantial advances made in the burning of coal from a cleanliness, an aesthetic, and a health point of view. In fact, we could burn coal, whether we want to or not is in question, but we could burn coal at our Port Jefferson units as cleanly as we burn oil. Now, that's not to say that anybody is really dying to go out there and do it. We will ultimately do it if the economics of the oil are such that they warrant what is, in fact, an expensive conversion process. We will get the required permits, and that'll take a few years, and at that time we'll look at the price of oil and where it appears to be going. Now, one of the things that we did do, knowing that a lot of people who live on the island remember back to the 40s and the 50s where this ugly, yucky stuff was burning all the time, there had been a community advisory council set up in the Port Jefferson area, which met with people from my company very, very frequently, and they've communicated their concerns to us. We have addressed a whole bunch of them, and that will continue if the decision is ultimately made to burn coal there, which again will depend on what the economics of coal versus oil are at that point.
And what about Jamesport?
Okay, Jamesport, to get a little bit legal about it, the New York State Siting Board last year, again, granted us a certificate to construct a couple of coal-fired power plants at our Jamesport site, which is on the North Shore in eastern Suffolk County.
I believe something was turned down as recently as last week.
Okay. This is a long legal turgid history, but what essentially happened at that point is looking where our capacity was and where our growth was, and the island's electric demand is still growing, but not nearly as fast as it had been 5 years ago and 10 years ago. LILCO asked the siting board early this year to rescind their permit granted to us to construct those coal plants, but then we asked them to suspend any action on rescinding it or in taking it back until we ultimately saw that the Shoreham plant would go online. Because right now, looking to the near future, the next 10 or 20 years, the next 10 years at least, we don't need the additional capacity that would be represented by the additional coal plants if the Shoreham power plant is operating. If Shoreham isn't operating, then we need that certified site to get coal plants built as fast as humanly possible.
So you admit there's a chance that Shoreham will not operate?
I don't think that's a very big chance. I think that you've got a plant that's followed all the safety rules, that was the subject of a 1,600-page decision by the federal government about a month and a half ago, in which the federal government government spent more than 7 years looking at each and every safety consideration and pronounced that our plant met all the codes, and that the only thing that they would recommend us loading fuel in that power plant as soon as we got our mechanical backup diesels fixed. I think that given that, and given the fact that at 5 separate occasions during the life of Shoreham, the state's Public Service Commission approved the continued building of that plant as in the need of the public interest, it would be very difficult right now for anything to formally, legally, or officially prevent Shoreham from going online. However, if anybody did somehow accomplish that, then it would be extremely important for us to get something else started building and online as soon as possible.
246-7901 is our telephone number, area code 516. Let's go to this call. USB, you're on the air.
Yes, a question for Ms. Hickman. Most people know that the electricity on the island comes from Norco, but so does the natural gas.
That's correct.
And I wonder if she could project at all what the cost of natural gas is going to be relative to electricity in Suffolk County over the next few years.
You know, electricity and natural gas are not really competitive in the sense that natural gas supplies the heating for about 17% of the homes on the island, and electricity, either resistance or heat pump, supplies only about 3 or 4% of the heating for the homes. However, I think what you're going for is that naturally all of us have had concerns about what would the effect of federal decontrol be on natural gas prices. The effect, in fact, over the last year or so was about a 14 or 15%, I believe, increase in the price of natural gas. However, we have seen, we feel, the bulk, if not all, of any increases that have resulted as a result of federal decontrol. In fact, we have, our natural gas prices have dropped in the last month or so about 4% because the price of natural gas has stabilized since we have seen basically the effects of decontrol. Now, natural gas is much more in the home heating sector, a competitor with oil heat. And in fact, the price of natural gas has for many, many years now been substantially below the price of oil for heating. Even with the increases in natural gas that we saw in the last year or so as a result of federal decontrol of gas prices, the difference between the two winds up where natural gas is still about 15%, I believe, cheaper than heating a home with oil.
No,
is that correct? Yeah. I'm sorry, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, you can also use natural gas in a cooking stove or in a
correct,
dryer.
Sir.
No,
that's right.
Compared to the cost of electricity.
Oh, I see what you're saying, sir. Correct. Okay. That application, now those applications are fairly limited. We have about 390,000 natural gas customers. About 190,000 of them are heating customers, and the rest are all a combination of cooking gas, water heating, and so forth. You're absolutely right in that one can elect to have either an electric stove or a electric clothes dryer versus a natural gas or a propane-fired clothes dryer or a natural gas stove. But the choice, the difference in dollars is there, but it's not all that substantial. I think the choice much more depends on what you've got coming into your house. For example, the person that I'm sitting with had her system converted to natural gas about a year or so ago, and for her it makes a great deal of economic sense. I might have an electric stove, an electric dryer right now, and prefer to stay with that, which in fact I do.
Does that answer your question, sir?
Well, do you have studies about, say, the comparative cost per BTU? That would...
Yes, we absolutely do, sir. That's through our marketing department, which is based in Mineola. And if you'd like to write to them or call them, they have analysts there that do this on a day-to-day basis, that type of comparison. That would be either addressed to or call to the Long Island Lighting Company Marketing Department, 250 Old Country Road, Mineola, 11501.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, sir. Our telephone number is 246-7901. We have about 8 minutes left. Our guest today, on Chatterbox is Jan Hickman from the Long Island Lighting Company. And let's go to this call. USB, you're on the air.
Yes.
About the diesel generators that broke down.
Yes, sir.
I understand that you are suing the company that manufactured the diesel generators.
Okay, now, we have not filed suit at this point. I'm sure that down the road at some time, that's something that we'll consider seriously. Now, right now, we're involved in a tremendously complex and lengthy analysis program with the federal government and a consultant called Failure Analysis Associates of Palo Alto, California. That's the same outfit, by the way, that successfully analyzed the cause of the walkway collapse at the Kansas City Hyatt a few years ago. They're one of the top international firms around. Now, we have been engaged in this analysis and will be yet for another month or two. We have already affected the cure to a substantial part of the diesel's problems. I think my point in bringing up all this history is that at some point, when we get the diesels running to our satisfaction, to the federal government satisfaction, and these are mechanical diesels, not nuclear part diesels.
Mm-hmm, I understand.
Of course you do.
Locomotive engines.
Exactly. They're just big loco size stuff. Yeah. When we get those running to the way that we want them to, and up to federal and industry codes, at that time we'll have the leisure, so to speak, to sit around and say, okay, now let's look at back to how the what caused the initial design error by the manufacturer, what we can recover from them, if anything, and at that time we'll seriously start exploring the idea of some type of legal action. But right now, anybody who's even close to those diesels is totally involved on a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week basis in getting them fixed and getting them running and getting them up to code.
Thanks for calling, sir. Our telephone number is 246-7901 if you have a question or a comment for Jan Hickman of Loco. USB, you're on the air.
Hello, is the prospect of nuclear fusion being considered by Loco rather than nuclear fission?
Okay, nuclear fusion is something that we participate in research about through a variety of industry and government groups. We contribute a couple of $1 million over the last few years into some very, very promising fusion research projects at Princeton, I believe, and at smaller scale ones at other campuses. Now, there's no question that that is going to be one of substantial. We believe that type of technology is going to be a substantial help in terms of power generation in years to come. But just like solar, we are pouring money into it, where we are pouring expertise into it, we're learning a lot from it, but we cannot realize any immediate benefit from it now. But certainly my children and your grandchildren maybe will all be able to benefit from that in the future, yes.
Wonderful.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye. A couple of weeks ago, Pat Halpin was on this program, and I believe Loco supported Mr. Halpin in his role as executive.
No. Loco never has and does not make endorsements of any political candidates.
Okay, I guess that was just a rumor that got spread around there.
We wouldn't even think of making a formal endorsement of candidates. It's just something that a utility wouldn't do.
How about a formal condemnation of say, Peter Kilhallen?
Not in terms of election, Eric. You know, that's something that the utility really wouldn't get involved in. What the people who work for it do is something else. We have 6,000 employees. Each and every one of them is free to vote, is free to work in their polls, is free to register, is free to do whatever they want to do. But Loco as a corporate entity makes no endorsement or condemnation on a political candidate basis. Now, we have disagreed openly, vociferously, and frequently with Mr. Kilhallen in the past over the Shoreham issue. But not in terms of an election campaign now.
Do you expect this will continue in the future, or was it just a political ploy?
I think that Mr. Kilhallen will probably continue some level of opposition. I don't know how great great it will be. Loco is ready now, and we always have been, to sit down in the most humble fashion possible and work with Mr. Kilhallen or any of his county people in trying to resolve the outstanding problems. We've been seeking that for years. We would be delighted at any time, any place, anywhere to sit down with Mr. Kilhallen or any of his people to try to iron out a number of his concerns.
Okay, 246-7901 is our telephone number. We have time for one or two quick calls. I have about 3 minutes left. USB, you're on the air.
Yes, I think Ms. Hickman is being disingenuous when she says Loco didn't support Halpin. Lilco executives gave a great deal of money to Halpin, and there is a political action committee of Lilco employees who also gave a great deal of money to Halpin. So
okay.
I must say her
a great deal of money is something.
Up so
okay,
well.
A great deal of money is something that I quarrel with. But as with any organization, a political action committee, it's called, in fact, ours is called the Local Employees Voluntary Political Action Committee. It's administered by employees. It does not seek, take, or use corporate funds or ratepayers' funds or shareholders' funds or any of that stuff. A number of other Long Island corporations, like Grumman, for example, also have political action committees, but those are not corporate funds. Now, who Lilco executives and employees choose to contribute to, whether it's the National Organization for Women, which I contribute to, or Newsday Adopt a Family, which I contribute to, or the Democratic Party, or the Republican Party, or any other party, is simply their own darn business. And there's no way that the corporation is going to play big brother and check out everybody's political or non-political contributions. By the way, I might add that if I read that same press story correctly, I think it detailed executives and other employees contributing money to the Democratic Party and not specifically to Mr. Halpin.
Does that answer your point, sir?
Not exactly.
Close enough?
Is there anything else you want to ask?
Well, it just seems to me if you give money to the Suffolk County Democratic Party, it's obviously going to Mr. Halpin. And
I think that's an assumption.
A number of Lilco executives gave $1,000 each.
And I'm sure that a number of other employees might have given to other groups, but nobody ever asked them about that.
Well, it doesn't show up in the Board of Elections records.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, sir. That's all the calls we have time for today, so please hold off if you have delayed until now your dialing. Jan Hickman, I want to thank you for coming up today.
Well, thank you, Eric. It's been a delightful experience for me, really. It's good being back home, in a sense.
Yeah. Nancy McKenko really didn't get a chance to say anything.
Nancy has a tremendous expertise, but we didn't touch on it.
Well, I'm sure if we need it, we can always draw upon it. Any last comments?
Just that I think the thought shouldn't be lost that Lilco is not some monolithic big brother corporation out there. It is, in fact, a corporation made up of 6,000 people, many of whom live and work among us and, in fact, are us. And those are the people who are the corporation. So the next time we're having bad thoughts about it, it is the guys in the yellow trucks, and it is the guys and ladies who answer the phones, and it is the people who are building the shore and power plants. So all those things are all part of one whole.
Well, good luck in what promises to be a very interesting next few years.
Yes, it will be.
Okay, thanks to everybody out there who gave us a call today on Chatterbox. We'll be back again next week at 2:30 p.m. Be sure to tune in every weekday at 2:30 p.m. for a different telephone talk show here on WUSB Stony Brook. Goodbye.
November 14th. This is the anniversary of the discovery of a white dwarf. More after this.
Stardate is made possible through an underwriting grant by AP Computer Products, located at Computer Headquarters on Middle Country Road in Selden.
Stardate November 14th. Here's a star you have to stay up late to see this month. Procyon, also known as the Little Dog Star. Procyon is fairly easy to spot in the evening each winter, but in November you can't see it until around midnight, when it's risen in the east and begun its slow march across the sky. Procyon is called a dog star because it's located in the constellation Canis Minor, the lesser dog. There's a constellation called the Greater Dog, too. And there's a Greater Dog Star, Sirius, the brightest star in the sky. But this is Procyon's day, the anniversary of the day that a companion was discovered for the little dog star. In 1896, the companion star was first seen as a tiny speck of light, 15,000 times fainter than Procyon. This glimmering pinpoint turned out to be a white dwarf, one of a class of mysterious old stars composed of matter never found on Earth or anywhere else in our solar system. The body of a white dwarf star consists of matter that has been crushed, squeezed to an extremely high density. The star bound to Procyon was once larger than its companion, larger than our own colossal sun. But as it grew old, it became unable to support itself against the crushing force of its own gravity. The star has collapsed to only about twice the size of Earth, with matter so dense that each cubic inch of the star would weigh approximately 2 tons. For November the 14th, that's Stardate. Our program is produced by the University of Texas McDonald Observatory in Austin, zip 78712. And for the McDonald Observatory, I'm Joel Block.
There's no chill, and yet I shiver. There's no flame, and yet I burn.
Next week on Curtain Up, we'll be saluting Barbra Streisand. I'm Mark Keller, inviting you to join me when Curtain Up follows Barbra Streisand's career from I Can Get It For You Wholesale to her newest film, Yentl. That's next Thursday evening at 7 o'clock p.m. on WUSB.
And I'm breathless to why I wonder. Weak one moment and the next I'm fine. I feel as if I'm falling every time I close my eyes, and flowing through my body is a river.
This is Don Hinckley, and I'm here at the tracking station at Cape Canaveral, where for the first time we'll be able to broadcast an in-flight conversation with an astronaut. Astronaut Jose Jimenez just cleared the launching pad 3 minutes ago. Let's see if we can get him. Jose Jimenez, can you hear me? Come in, please.
Hello, what did you say?
Come in, please.
Oh, I want to.
Mr. Jimenez, you're screaming a bit loud.
Yes.
Your mic is turned up too high.
Well, the mic? Wait a minute, I'll turn it on.
You mean you were screaming that loud? Don't tell me you're afraid.
Okay, I'll keep it a secret.
Tell me, sir, could you direct your attention to the porthole?
Okay, I will direct my attention on the porthole.
What do you see?
My reflection.
I mean, sir, what does it look like?
Very scary.
Is there anything obstructing your view?
Well, yes, there's some moisture forming.
On the glass?
No, in my eyes.
You're not crying, sir.
Gee, a guy can't have any secrets out here.
Well, is everything A-OK now?
No, it's still B-A-D. Yes. And it's going to get W-O-R-S.
Sir, I...
Yes.
Sir, I
keep
just...
Keep talking. I like your company.
Sir! Sir?
Yes?
I just want to find out what you see. Is there anything up there that you didn't expect to find?
Oh, yes. Me.
Well, you certainly must have known that they were going to send you up when you volunteered.
When I what?
Volunteered. You know what volunteer means.
Yes, you lose the toss.
Sir, have you cleared the Earth's atmosphere yet?
No, but it could use some clearing, especially around Los Angeles. It's not too clean over in Paris either.
Well, tell me, sir, how does the Earth look from up there?
Oh, very good.
According to our calculations, sir, you're now traveling faster than the speed of light.
I thought so. I thought so because I've been trying to read.
Been trying to read?
What have
you been?
Right.
What have you been? What, sir, have you been trying to read?
My insurance policy.
Oh.
Even the large print doesn't cover this.
Well, anyway, that's certainly an amazing speed.
Well, it's more amazing than you think.
Why is that?
I'm still in first.
Well, they say that capsule does handle like a car.
Yes, I wish I had a reverse on it.
Mr. Jimenez, you've gone through the troposphere and the now.
Just plain fear.
Sir, in 2 minutes, you've mentioned being afraid 3 times.
Stick around. I might break the record.
Well, Jose, you know, don't forget, there's always the emergency escape button.
It doesn't work.
How do you know?
Because I pushed it already.
When?
On the launching pad.
Sir, let's talk about your return to Earth.
Oh, yes, let's. Now that's my favorite song.
Are you worried about re-entering the Earth's atmosphere?
Oh, no.
That's good.
I'm worried about re-entering the Earth.
I'd like to check a few things with you, sir.
Go ahead. I got nothing to do. All right.
Down here,
yes.
Doctors have said that space travel can cause amnesia. Have you been affected by that?
Been affected by what?
Never mind.
Never what?
Forget it.
I did.
Let's change the subject. Mr. Menace, what have they provided for your amusement up there?
Well, among other things, they got a small motion picture camera for my trip back, but I don't like the choice of movie.
Oh, what was it?
Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Do you, sir, can you tell us what the temperature is inside the capsule?
Could you repeat the question?
Could you tell us what the temperature is inside the capsule?
Wait a minute, I'll go in and see.
Don't tell me you're outside the capsule. That's the worst thing I've ever heard.
I got something even worse to tell you.
What?
I lost the key. It's okay, I'm inside again. I found it. It was under the mat.
What's that? Yes, all right, just a moment. Sir, I don't know how to tell you this, but I've just received word that the retro rockets that must fire to get you back to Earth are not functioning.
What? The retro
rockets that must fire to get you back to Earth are not functioning. I don't know how to tell you this.
You don't know how to tell me that?
No.
Tell me when I get back. Hey, look, don't get around about that. Hey, no kidding.
Now, calm down. Calm down.
I want to calm down. I want to...
Mr. Menace, while we're waiting for the report on the retro rockets.
Oh, sure, while we're waiting for the report.
Yes. We've arranged for a history-making event.
No kidding.
We have a number of reporters here, and this will be the first in-space press conference. They'll be asking you questions right now, and if it's all right with you.
Well, I'll hang around and wait for them.
All right. May we have the first question, please?
How does it feel to hurtle through space?
Excuse me?
How does it feel to hurtle through space?
How does it feel to hurtle through space? It hurtles.
Have
I passed the Russian capsule? I didn't even swallow it. What can you do to help the race for space? Don't enter. Yes.
Is your wife worried?
Is my wife worried? No, but I wish she was here. Instead of me.
Yes.
Yes.
Where would you like to land?
Where would I like to land? Well, I think I'm going to end up in China. Via Salt Lake City.
How do you feel being sealed up in a spacesuit?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
How do you feel being sealed up in a spacesuit?
I can't hear you. I'm sealed up in this spacesuit. Yes.
Think about
the guys' girls.
Please?
Which kind of women are out in space? Listen, you get over to the launching pad and tell them Jose sent for you. And don't hurt anything. Excuse me?
How's your decompression chamber?
Crazy, how's yours? Yeah, then... Yes.
Do you have any regrets?
Do I what, sir?
Do I have any regrets?
Wait a minute, I'll get out the list. No, I'm very happy to do this for my country. Whatever it is. Excuse me?
What color are you?
What color am I? At the moment? I'm passing through fuchsia.
Can you swim?
I can't swim even if I don't land in the ocean. You would like to know where I am going in such a hurry. I will check my instruments and be back with you.
You feel you're being well paid for your job.
Yes, I am being paid very well. They pay me piece work. I don't know what that means. But I did get paid in advance. Which was... Any other questions?
Mr. Jimenez.
Yes.
Do you suffer from acrophobia?
Do I suffer from acrophobia? Just from the pronunciation. Yes.
Which do you think is more important to say, the capsule or the man?
Which is more important, to save the capsule or the man? Would you like my opinion? Mine or Admiral Rickover? Yes.
Do you need
leisure time?
Please?
What do you do in your leisure time?
What do I do in my leisure time? Yeah. I make model airplanes. And stick pins in them. Yes.
Did they let the mouse out?
Did they let the mouse out? You mean I got to spend the rest of the trip on this chair? Yes.
What's the first thing you plan to do when you return?
I can tell you the second thing. Take off my space suit. I got why? Because I got to get my rest.
What's your present position?
Cramped up near the door. I'm in this position near the door because I plan to get out first.
Well, sir, I think our time is up.
Hey, don't get around about that.
I would just like to say, sir, that if anyone ever deserved praise and commendation, you do.
No, that's not true at all. I do not deserve anything.
You've proven yourself to be a hero.
No, you are wrong. I do not deserve anything at all.
Why do you say that?
Well, I got to make a confession.
What's that?
This is a recording. A recording. Recording. Course.
This is Radio Free Long Island. This is radio station WUSB, Stony Brook, USA, operating on an assigned frequency of 90.1 MHz, FCC Channel 211. This transmission for North America is heard from 2100 to 2300 hours each Monday.
With the Campus Bulletin Board, presented daily on WUSB as a student service. Today, Monday, November 14th at 7:30 p.m., there will be a conference entitled The Student Behind the Iron Curtain, including a forum, speakers, and debates. The program will be in the Craft Center lower level of the library. It is sponsored by the Department of Germanic and Slavic Languages and the Slavic Club. The instrumental jazz workshop with professional jazz artists will meet at 6 p.m. in the Music Wing, second floor of the Fine Arts Center. The program is sponsored by the International Art of Jazz. The Black Women's Forum presents Black...